cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, as we try to figure out the new way forward when it comes to the metaverse, crypto, and so much more, there's something going on in the video game industry that may already give you a clue about the future.
Brian Feldman writes all about it. He's a freelance reporter for Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the phone from Brooklyn. Check out Brian's story. It's online right now. It's called The Game Industry's NFT Failures Hold Lessons for the Metaverse. We've also got with us right now Joel Weber. He is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Joel, it's all fun and games until the publisher. Oh, man.
Yeah, you guys see what you did there.
You did. Until the publisher of your video game. And by the way, your video game is, you know, tied its image closely to making fun of pretty much everything when it comes to the crypto universe and everything related. Starts selling NFTs for real money.
Yeah. And you know, there's been, I think, a lot written about how there's a lot of potential in NFTs. And what I was intrigued by and what we were intrigued by here was that video game, the gaming industry was got in on this really quickly, and there's a bit of tension there, which is that the gamers themselves weren't as into it. And so that piqued our interest, and Brian did a great job with the story. So Brian, tell us more. How did video gamers beat NFTs?
I'm trying to think of the short version of it. Basically, gamers for about a decade and a half have had to sort of tolerate increasingly aggressive pricing models for games. So where you used to pay, you know, one price for one game and take the entire thing home, now you sort of have to buy it piecemeal perpetually into the future in order to participate in online games, the types of which the metaverse wants to be. Because these games are perpetual and so susceptible to public feedback, gamers made themselves known. They immediately registered their annoyance with the idea of pushing NFTs into the space and sort of scared a lot of people off of their initial curiosity.
So let's spin it forward a little bit, because as we teased a little bit, the metaverse has some interesting interesting in and of itself, right? But what does this potentially hold for games and where the metaverse could go?
I mean, I think in terms of what, you know, people theorize the metaverse to be, you can look at pre-existing games and sort of get an idea. You know, Fortnite is referred to as a sort of metaverse game where winning is sort of less of an objective than just, like, hanging out with people and doing funny dances and stuff. Minecraft, similarly. And so if you look at those as a model for like sort of prototypical metaverses that already have millions of early adopters, then trying to sort of push NFTs or crypto things or experiences that people don't necessarily want on something they're already used to is a problem that I think a lot of companies are going to experience.
Well, Brian, this was like the one place that the metaverse was supposed to succeed, that crypto was supposed to succeed, that NFTs were supposed to succeed, right? It was, and many people have argued that, you know, even if they do only succeed in gaming, it's such a huge industry that that's kind of enough. What does this say about a company like Facebook that's trying to, you know, pivot into going all in on the metaverse and get us to do our meetings in the metaverse if NFTs can't take off when it comes to gaming?
I mean, I think some of it has to do with messaging. You know, I think for a long time, game companies have put out, you know, pre-rendered trailers that show, you know, fantastical ideas of like what they hopefully think the finished product will look like, and have faced a lot of criticism and backlash when the finished product falls short of that. And so I think some of it has to do with realizing that possible metaverse consumers are a lot more tech savvy and a lot more wary of marketing material than tech companies might think. And so it's about, you know, making sort of a clear an accurate message to them rather than just saying, well, we hope it's like this one day. It's about expressing like what the tangible benefit is currently or in the near future.
Okay, so you have this great line in here. Digital horse armor may be a waste of money, but it can at least be fun. So, I mean, there could be fun, but maybe NFTs aren't exactly what people are looking for. And that gets to this idea that, you know, as you write, that NFTs are sort of inherently vehicles for financial speculation. So I'm curious, how has this gone over within the game industry itself? Like, because they were the ones that were sort of administering the Kool-Aid in this instance.
So a lot of gaming-related NFT programs that were announced sort of towards the end of last year and at the beginning of this year never really made it off the ground because, you know, they were announced before they had actually launched, and then because of consumer backlash, they quickly backed off. The sort of one example that did really see it all the way through was this Ubisoft program that gave people NFTs for playing one of their games, Ghost Recon Breakpoint, I believe. And you could earn them by getting a certain number of kills or spending enough time in the game even. And because it's all on the blockchain, you can track that activity.
And the numbers aren't so great, are they? Just quickly, just got about 20 seconds.
No, they are not. They are in, I believe, like the four figures at this point if you exchange the crypto they're into to real money.
That includes the cents, right? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, and you can read those numbers in the story. Hey, listen, Brian, thank you so much. Brian Feldman, he's freelance reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. Check out this story online at Bloomberg Businessweek. And our thanks to Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So much going on when it comes to the big banks. And of course, we had some more earnings this morning. They're all on our radar again. B of A shares rallying as loan revenue topped estimates. Also net interest income up 24% to the highest level in at least a decade. You've got Goldman also higher. They're reporting earnings tomorrow. But we got some news that's going to combine its investment banking and trading business. And then there's some stuff on Credit Suisse. Oh my God, I'm exhausted already.
Well, fortunately, we have Srinatarajan here to help us out because he can report on all that and more. He's finance reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Sri, I want to start with the Goldman story. Goldman shaking up its leadership ranks in yet another overhaul. What's the big headline here? What's the reorg? Who's taking over for these divisions?
I'll start with the last three words of that headline: yet another overhaul. And I feel, to some extent, that's more the news than actually what they're moving around. It's not the rearranging of the deck chairs, to be clear, without any iceberg in sight. But it is not about the changes itself,
yeah,
but the fact that it's happening again, because David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, is 4 years into the top job at the Wall Street giant. And this is the third major restructuring he's undertaking. Not just that. With this move, he will be undoing a lot of the signature moves he put in place and changes he made just 2 years ago. That is not a good look, and that gives a little bit of whiplash to investors. So let me actually step in and tell you what the changes are. You have a Goldman Sachs with four distinct divisions, trading, investment banking, two units where their strength is, it's fair to say, unparalleled. Then they had this asset management business, which is the Goldman Sachs asset management business, investing in public markets on behalf of other investors, as well as this merchant bank, which was sort of their in-house private equity shop. And then the fourth pillar, which was actually created in 2020, was this consumer and wealth management business, because that catered to individual money. Some very, 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 very rich people and some average Joes, but those were all people that Goldman was targeting. They've wiped the slate clean. They've combined banking and trading in a way to try and showcase to the market that, hey, if you see banking and trading as one combined group, similar to how JP Morgan does it, similar to how Morgan Stanley does it, you may be able to appreciate how, well, I can't use the word, so how good it is. That's one goal with CIB. Then what they did, and we've talked about for a few months now, they've had major issues with their consumer business. They're effectively dismembering that, bringing back wealth management into their asset management business, shoving a part of their direct-to-consumer business, which operated under the Marcus brand name, into that unit. And then the third is this weirdly named business called Platform Solutions. It has such a McKinseyan ring to it. But it is taking their, you know, the online loans provider that they bought last year, GreenSky, the credit card partnerships, which is the ones that they have with Apple and General Motors, and the transaction banking business, bringing it under one roof, having it as a standalone business. Think of it somewhat like embedded finance, which a lot of people are hot on, including McKinsey. Wow, I'm actually close on this McKinsey conspiracy theory. They might have been behind this name. To be clear, I do not know for sure.
I hear some reporting a little bit later on.
But it is a standalone business, and it will be interesting to watch, because that business will report losses for the foreseeable future, for the next quarter or two or three or four or more. Not many Wall Street banks have a standalone division that where the P&L will be so visible and so painful. Goldman's got to hope that investors don't pay too much scary attention to it, are willing to cut them some slack, and actually see the new narrative that they're trying to spread and believe in it.
What prompted this shift?
A number of things. First off, why this shift? Just in January, you did a massive change of the asset management leadership. In 2020, we just talked about all the other changes they made. But the mumbling and grumbling outside of Goldman Sachs had been clear for the better part of the last 6 months. They worried about the situation in the asset management group and how the new leadership is getting along. They really worried about the consumer business, which, as we've reported, at mid-year they projected would lose well more than $1.2 billion in a year when the bank's total earnings is expected to drop 40% from the success, the fabulous success they had in 2021. That was just too harsh a spotlight on that business, so it was clear something had to be done. And it's fair to say that the problems with consumer accelerated some of the discussions they had about other reorgs. If you're bringing back asset and wealth management and making it this large one unit, you probably do the CIB aspect of it. The banking and trading combination is something people had been pushing for at the firm. David Solomon and his team had been reluctant about that because they were more interested in steering investor attention towards asset management and consumer, those recurring fee businesses that they think investors will appreciate. Now that they've actually made this combined banking, global banking and markets group, perhaps it's an acknowledgement that maybe it is fair to shine the spotlight on their crown jewel, and maybe it will give them a boost with investors. That we don't know yet, and that we'll see over the coming months and quarters.
All right. Well, an incredible story. And then ahead of course, Goldman has its earnings tomorrow. We're going to leave it on that note. Bloomberg News finance reporter Sri Natarajan in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Shares of Goldman Sachs, by the way, they are up 2% in today.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Today's session.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we've been talking about the Chinese markets. We see Chinese ADRs trading up, this on news that Chinese regulators are ramping up efforts to support the stock market. You've got a lot going on, a lot of news flow out of China generally, and what is one of the key economies of our time.
Yeah, very busy weekend as President Xi reaffirmed policies at the center of frictions with the U.S. He spent 2 hours hitting back, and it was opened in this crucial party gathering. We got Eric Schatzker with us. He's editorial director for Bloomberg New Economy. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Eric, before we went to you, we talked a little bit about what happened over the weekend in China. We also talked a little bit about another lockdown of more than a million people in China. And I'm thinking to myself, in a country the size of China that has a policy for COVID zero that we already know has affected the country's economy so much, how does something like this actually end? I mean, how do we go back to a China that isn't increasingly isolating itself from the rest of the world?
It's an excellent question. As far as COVID goes, and you'll hear me say this word again and again and again, it's all about control, right? Demonstrating that the Chinese political model is superior to the model that we practice here in the West, where we had COVID restrictions initially, but eventually recognized that the economy had to reopen because we operate a democratic society where people's free will counts for something. It's consistent with what we heard from President Xi over the weekend. What he talked about, or let me say this, his commentary pointed to a China that on the one hand is more geopolitically assertive, but on the other hand is more economically isolated and less of a trading partner to the rest of the world. Again, because of control, he, and I'm sure you've been talking about the response in his speech to the U.S. ban on exports of advanced semiconductors and related equipment. He talked about winning the battle in key core technologies and moving faster and achieving technology self-reliance. But the challenge for President Xi and for China is that he envisions this being done within a political framework that prioritizes, above all, ideological rectitude, national security, and party control. There's that control word again. This is not the China that evolved into something resembling capitalism, right? In the years, in the, you know, three decades, really, and plus, that followed Deng Xiaoping's reforms back in 1978. For the past at least 5 years, if not more, President Xi has been growing suspicious of market forces and the threats that they present to political stability, and the perceived threat that he feels, or felt anyway, and may no longer feel because he's put them in a box, from tycoons like Jack Ma and Pony Ma.
So how do we need to think, I think, about our audience, the investing audience, how do we need to think about China going forward? For so many years, right, for so long, it was all about global multinationals looking to get into China, have access to that market. So what is it going forward?
Well, China will be more inwardly focused. And those who were counting on Xi to reverse course and increase access may find themselves disappointed. I will emphasize that it is awfully hard to make anything that sounds like a prediction. First of all, you know, he hasn't yet secured his third term as president. The Communist Party Congress doesn't end until the 22nd of this month. It still has a few days to run.
But it's expected.
Yes, yes, yes. It's widely baked into the cake. But if he insists that Chinese scientific advances and innovation need to fall under the umbrella of state control, which is to say largely done by or directed by state-owned enterprises, it will look very different from what we know in the West and what China was increasingly looking like, which was a somewhat centrally planned but nevertheless still capitalist economy. And if you take that to its logical conclusion, to me anyway, it begins to sound a lot like the Soviet Union. And it's not to say that the Soviet Union didn't have brilliant scientists and didn't achieve great things technologically. It did. If you think about the things that the Soviets did with their space program, if you think about the things that the Soviets did militarily, like develop fighters like the MiG-25 and the MiG-29 that were every bit as competitive with what the United States and Europe could produce, and in many cases better, but ultimately not sustainable. Not sustainable technologically and not sustainable politically. And I don't need to remind everybody what happened in 1989.
But Eric, in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, given that pretty much every single American company wants access to China, does that...
Still.
Does that portend potentially a different ending?
It does. What they see there is 1.4 billion people to whom they want to sell things. You know, that's a very naked commercial instinct. But, you know, if you're a shareholder of a company that's looking to grow revenue and grow earnings, it's logical. Yeah. But bit by bit by bit, you have to ask yourself, if you're the CEO or the board of that company, is this viable over the long run, given right. What we keep hearing out of President Xi?
Because it does seem like the risks continue to increase. Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director Eric Schatzker here in our Interactive Broker studio. Eric, thanks.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, just under 10 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up that Monday trade. And what a trade it is. While we have seen some movement, mostly it's game on and it's one for the bulls because we've got a broad-based rally underway.
Yeah, I've just heard the numbers from Charlie, but worth repeating. The NASDAQ higher by 3.6, the S&P higher by 2.9, and the Dow higher by 2% right now. Let's get into it with David at
Game Deets. On. Isn't that Wayne's World, too?
Party on.
Party on?
Yeah.
Excellent. Sorry.
I love it, Carol. Blast from the past. David Dietz is managing principal and senior investment strategist at PPAC, Private Wealth Management, about $9.5 billion in assets under management. David joins us once again on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. So, David, is the worst behind us? Are we turning over a new leaf this week and for the remainder of the year?
Well, we don't know whether we've seen the bottom in this cyclical downturn, but we do know that the conditions are primed for better returns going forward. I mean, we start with the fact that we're down 25% year-to-date on the broad market, 35% on the NASDAQ. That alone should whet the appetite of all bargain hunters. On top of that, some of the macro factors that have really beaten down stocks, like a surging U.S. dollar and surging interest rates, reverse course today. Now, the bond market has seen yields go higher for 11 weeks in a row. Well, we know that yields don't grow to the sky. And so certainly the reversal today, I think, really helped people take more confidence that there was some limit to how high yields would be. And we know that bonds compete mightily for investors' attention with stocks.
Right. So it's always a comparison, right, in terms of fixed income bonds versus what we're seeing in terms of valuations and yield on the equity side of things. Having said that, at this point, you've got, David, some specific names on the equity side of things that you like, and among them is Tyson. Tell us about the story and the thinking behind that.
Well, you know, in this part of the economic cycle, we're looking for market leaders. And when you look at the food category, we're talking chicken, we're talking beef, we're talking pork. Tyson is the absolute leader. They have a real lock on the domestic market, outpacing their competitors like Pilgrim's Pride. And increasingly, they're exporting to places like China, which has been battling swine flu and so forth. But this is a stock that, you know, was over about $90 earlier in the year and has come back mightily. Now it's got a six handle. And so, you know, you got a market leader that now is trading at less than 10 times earnings, a company that has a history of buying back their stock and increasing their dividend. And this is the type of thing we think where investors have gone too sour on the name, and it's going to come back.
Okay. What about Berkshire Hathaway? That's one of the companies on your list as well. Why are you bullish on Berkshire?
Well, you can't look at Berkshire without thinking about Warren Buffett. Of course, you've got the most successful investor, arguably, in the world, still on top of the helm there. You know, this is a treasure trove, Tim, of blue-chip publicly traded stocks. We're talking Coca-Cola, we're talking Apple, we're talking American Express, and, of course, great privately traded companies, not small ones. We're talking Burlington Northern Railroad, Geico Insurance, some utilities in the Midwest, and they're trading just a little bit above book value. A couple things I think are the catalysts. One is, of course, interest rates have moved up. Now, they're famous for having all this insurance money float. Some of it they put to work. Others have been having challenges putting to work. And, of course, now they're getting a much better yield. And on the three-month treasury, you can get 3.8% versus nil about a year ago. On top of that, I like the fact that the heir apparent, Greg Abel, most likely to take over when Warren Buffett passes the baton, just bought $80 million worth of stock. Well, he's operating in a microscope. Everyone in the world is looking at the timing of this pick. He doesn't take throwing $80 million into his stock where he's going to be moving up, hopefully, lightly. So I think that is a great buy signal. And, of course, if Berkshire Hathaway continues to struggle, they have a great record of buying back shares. So that gives you a bit of a floor if you're worried about further volatility ahead.
What do you make of, you know, it's funny, we don't talk about the Dow a lot because I think of its, you know, limited names in the index. But having said that, the Dow is just down about 16% this year. That compares with about 22% downside on the S&P 500 and more than 30%, as you mentioned earlier, on the NASDAQ 100. For the Dow to see some outperformance, albeit not that much, but nonetheless outperformance, what does that say about you, kind of the Dow industrials doing better than what we're seeing in the broader market and certainly a lot better than what we're seeing on the tech side of things?
Well, so
because you just talked about blue chips, right, and liking Berkshire. So I'm just wondering what the bigger theme here is.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, frankly, the Dow has lagged over the last decade because so much attention has been focused and money chasing those tech stocks. And, of course, those have been hit really hard. The valuations got the nosebleed levels, fears of recession. On top of that, of course, with the higher interest rates, investors are discarding those stocks which have so-called long-dated earnings because they're marked down much lower to present value when interest rates go up. The Dow is much less focused on those high valuation growth names, and so I think it's been their turn in the sun. You've got more companies, your banks, for example, J.P. Morgan and American Express, your chemical companies like Dow, which are not only making good money now relative to stock prices, but also are paying a good dividend. And I think as interest rates move up, people have gravitated towards those lower duration equity names.
Hey, David, before we let you go, talk a little bit about inflation and what you're seeing, because we got some concerning comments from Mark Mobius a little earlier today. What do you think is happening with inflation?
You know, so the latest numbers are terrible. So there's two things I would say. One is I think inflation is starting to roll over, quite frankly. Why do I think that? One is commodities tend to be a leading indicator inflation-wise. You look at the price of oil, it's got an 80 handle versus, you know, close to 130 late spring. Ditto with all your other commodities as well. We also are seeing distinct signs that the economy is starting to slow. And when people have less money to spend, companies are pulling in their belts, they're not going to pay those high prices. And so we're going to see prices come back. So I think that inflation is going to tend to roll over. Finally, stock investors are still worried about inflation. I think your risk and the downside, if inflation takes longer to purge from the system, is smaller than your upside if, in fact, we get some good news here on inflation.
All right. Well, certainly one take on inflation and where it goes. David Dietz, thank you so much. Managing Principal and Senior Investment Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management, roughly $9.5 billion in assets under management, joining us once again on the phone from Summit, New Jersey.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.